Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. Local opposition emerges from activist Reverend William Barber over Charlotte's 1 cent sales tax for transit referendum.
We're against constantly being taxed in ways that hurt the poor and working poor.
Concerns over ICE coming into schools is a key topic of conversation among those attending the last CMS school board meeting prior to the start of school. South Carolina Republican Nancy Mace utters what some consider a transgender slur while campaigning for that state's governor. That in the shadow of Pride Week in Charlotte, which itself is under the shadow of dwindling corporate support in the Trump era. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE education reporter James Farrell. Ben Thompson is morning and midday anchor at WCNC-TV, and Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here.
Morning.
So it took years for Charlotte's transit plan to garner support in the General Assembly. That support came suddenly earlier this summer when they gave us permission to put a referendum for a 1 cent sales tax to support the plan on the November ballot. Then several weeks passed. And then finally, the Mecklenburg County Commission gave its final go-ahead for the plan. That leaves little time, however, for proponents to explain to voters what's in the plan and persuade them to vote yes. And that means very little room for error. But this week, opposition came from a prominent civil rights leader, Reverend William Barber, who took to the pulpit to make his opposition known.
This will be the fourth tax in 2 years. School bond, county property tax. And we're not necessarily against tax. We're against constantly being taxed in ways that hurt the poor and working poor while the wealthy and the greedy never pay their fair share. That's the problem.
Barber was guest speaker during a Sunday sermon at First Baptist Church West, and this was only part of what he spoke about in that sermon. Did this come, Ben, as a surprise to people, his opposition? Hold on, we're not hearing Ben. I'm going to ask. There we go. Go ahead.
Okay, you got me now. Yeah, I think it's surprising to people that they're not breaking along party lines. To be overly simplistic about this, I think you have people who are part of the elected establishment, Democrats and Republicans, people at the government center uptown, people up at the General Assembly in Raleigh, who are supporting this because of the work they put into it over the last years. But then you have those unelected people, whether it's Reverend Barber, whether it's Jennifer Roberts or Braxton Winston, who are coming out and saying this is not in the best interest of working folks. And then, of course, you're going to always have the conservatives who say, hey, a tax is never going to be something I get on board. So it's making for slightly strange bedfellows who's coming out in support of this tax and who's not.
And of course, he was the face of the Moral Monday movement and demonstrations in Raleigh a while back. He is the most high profile, I think, leader to speak out against this tax, or high profile, non-elected, former elected, because we'll talk about some of the other people who has come out because it's enjoyed broad support among political, religious and nonprofit leaders. But he has cast this tax as sinful.
Because the Bible says that usury is sin. Charging people interest and wrongful tax is sin because it most often hurts the poorest.
This is something we've talked about, but not from this point of view. How influential is his opposition likely to be, either among other leaders or among people who might be encouraged to vote no?
Well, I think it gives cover for some other leaders. I mean, what it is, I mean, he's a well-known, not just local, but national civil rights leader. And for him to come out of it and be against, I think the biggest problem he and other people are going to have is funding. You've got a robust amount of money pouring into the coffers from the business community to sort of push this transit plan ahead. And then you've got the establishment both here in Charlotte and Raleigh also supporting it as well. So they do face an uphill battle, I feel like, in this campaign.
Alex?
Yeah, the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance, they have a $3 million campaign to try to convince voters to say yes to this. And I think that's also just one of the arguments itself is that it kind of seems like a one-sided debate. You have a limited amount of time, a ton of money funneling into the yes vote, and then a very you have very few people who are actually voicing any criticism or looking at any opposition on this, because I think that we just spent so much time, like, let's get this through the General Assembly, that now we have it, it's like, let's just pass it. And now people are starting to poke holes into the actual transportation plan and asking, are we actually going to get what we want out of this?
Because all sales taxes are regressive, because they cost the same amount of money for people who make no money and as they do for people who are multimillionaires, this is going to hit the poor harder than it's going to hit the wealthier among us. And he says this may give us better transit options, but like the buses running on time and more frequently, but it will only take you to a low wage job. This is a quote, because the politicians won't fight for you to have a living wage. He's turned this into a social justice issue.
He has, but I mean, keep in mind, this is a transit plan. This is not an affordable housing plan. This is not a better jobs plan. It's a transit plan. And I think, you know, you talk to the people who have done the work of trying to put this together up at the government center, both behind the scenes and on council. And I think they feel like, practically speaking, as a matter of politics, they are not going to get a better deal than this when it comes to getting folks in Raleigh to sign off on this. Because keep in mind, Democrats here in Charlotte can talk about this till they're blue in the face. But if they don't get the permission of the folks in Raleigh and get their signature, then it doesn't even matter. So I am sure there's a lot of Democrats out there. I'm sure there's a lot of liberals who would like to see more from this transit plan. No doubt about it. But are they going to get the buy-in from people like Phil Berger up in the General Assembly? And the answer is more than likely, absolutely not.
And it was a rough slog to get this approved by the legislature. And it's been positioned by proponents as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, that we will not get this chance again. Do you think that's true? If voters say no, can we retool this, go back to the legislature and ask for permission to do it again?
I don't think there's going to be much of an appetite for there. Now, when I talked to the mayor about this a few months ago, she said, okay, you know what, if it doesn't pass this year, we'll do it again next year. I don't know how likely that actually is in practice. And I would love to think that Republicans in Raleigh have a real vested interest in transit here in Charlotte, but I don't know that that's been really exhibited in the last few years beyond what the current plan is.
Alex.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest issues with the bill is that it did become so restrictive, because we were trying to appease people. We were trying to make sure we had the red line in there. We were trying to make sure we weren't replacing old road money with new road money. So we started adding all these provisions to the bill. And if it goes back, if it fails and goes back, we're just asking for more restrictions. So at this point, I think the best thing to do is to advocate for a better transportation plan. If you don't like, you know, you advocate for the Silver Line, for example. Is there a way we can switch out money for the Gold Line, for the Silver Line? Those type of things. Those are the things that we can be debating. But if it goes back to General Assembly, it's just going to get even more restrictive. It's going to cause more issues.
Yeah, because keep in mind the algorithm that's been set for the 40-40-20, 40% rails, 40% roads, 20% for microtransit and buses. That was not the city's creation. That was the creation from folks up in the General Assembly in Raleigh. So I think city leaders, had they had their druthers, this would almost be an all train sort of transit plan. It would not involve those others. But that was sort of a compromise to get it to happen.
Alex?
Another example I'll point out. There were some concerns brought up by Reverend Ricky Woods about roads and how 40% of the money would go to roads. That's an opportunity to advocate there, because it's not just roads. It could be bike lanes, sidewalks. So if there are concerns about that 40%, you can have a say in how much of that actually is going to paving versus different types of intersections and street lighting and what have you.
Yeah, his point was that 40% of this money, if we say yes to the referendum, will go to roads. Local jurisdictions will have a lot of say-so over how that money is spent, as you just alluded to. But according to the Charlotte Observer, he said that each city cares for its own city roads and states oversee state and federal roads. Nearly 70% of state and local road use taxes cover the cost of road funding in the state. And he said we should not be paying twice for the same thing. Would we be?
To me, it's not exactly clear that that's what would happen. I understand. I've heard other people say the same thing. To me, it's not exactly clear that's exactly what happened. But I mean, he shares the concerns that a lot of people had in creating this. I think it's a matter here of do you want the current transit plan, understanding that it is not perfect. But after years and years and years of trying, this is what a compromise solution was, or not.
I want to go back to the quote I read from Reverend William Barber, who said that these buses or this transit plan may take you, the buses that result from this may take you to a low-wage job because the politicians won't fight for you to have a living wage. And earlier this summer, Mayor Vi Lyles cast a deciding vote on council against sending to committee for discussion a request by the Service Employees Union at the airport to improve working conditions there. Were his remarks directed at her?
I think indirectly that's what a lot of people think. And I think a lot of people think her vote was to not scare any people in the business community while we were trying to get this transit plan passed after 5 years. And listen, let's be honest. I mean, when it comes to this additional sales tax, it's not going to apply to groceries and prescriptions. They're exempt to address some of these concerns that people have, these valid concerns. And let's also not forget that there's a valid point to be made when it comes to these rail lines. If past is prologue, look at the blue line, both south of town, look at it north of town. These rail lines can often displace low-income communities because they become hot real estate. I mean, South End is sort of nationally heralded as a perfect example of economic development, but is also not affordable for anything. Right. And a similar situation has now happened north of Uptown in NoDa and other places. So yeah, those are real legitimate concerns that these folks are going to be displaced, even despite attempts to make that not happen.
So, Alex, you mentioned the $3 million that the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance is going to fund the campaign to get us to say yes to these in November. But this vote is coming, whether we say yes or no, the vote is coming in an off-year election in which very few people will vote. Does that help or hurt its chances for passage or failure?
I really can't tell because I feel like, you know, you're going to have educated voters show up. And I think if you're really educated on this issue, you could go either way. You might look at it and you see that $130 extra a low-income household is going to pay per year. Or you might look at it like, well, we're never going to get this chance again. And I live in North Mecklenburg and I want the red line. So I think that it could go either way.
So if passed, sales tax will go to 8.25%, and we vote on this in November. Meanwhile, the Charlotte Gateway Station suffered a setback this week. We only have about a minute left in this segment, Alex, and we can go into the next segment on this. But this is the plan to build a transit hub uptown, and you reported on this yesterday. What is this all about?
Yeah, I got, you know, it's difficult to explain quickly, so I'll have to come back to it, but the Charlotte Gateway Station, it's been in planning for years, and I've gotten some records that show that it just seems like we've run into even more hangups between the city kind of waiting to see what happens with this sales tax and the Department of Transportation really wanting to get this done because they want to run trains there by 2030, within 5 years.
And now they're saying they may have to delay it. This has been part of the master plan, I think, for Charlotte's transit dreams for a long time. And now they're talking about a possible delay, and they're blaming the city. And we'll talk about why and more when we come back, including a little look at the opening days of school that have already started in some districts and will start soon in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, and concerns over the presence of ICE on those campuses and more. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. James Farrell is with us, WFAE's education reporter. He will chime in mostly in a moment when we talk about CMS. Ben Thompson is here. He's the morning and midday anchor for WCNC-TV. And Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And yesterday in Axios, you were reporting about the possible delay of the beginnings of the construction for the Charlotte Gateway Center, which has been part of our master plan for transit for years. This is where trains would come together uptown so people could get easy access, not just to the blue line, red line, silver line, if they ever come to be, but also the Amtrak trains. And NCDOT wants to get started on this. They wanted it completed by 2030, as you said a moment ago, to service the arrival of new trains, but they're blaming Charlotte for potential delays. They had a plan to build a temporary station by 2027. They put that on hold yesterday, and they seem to connect that to the sales tax referendum. We've all known for a very long time that this referendum, if it was going to happen, was going to happen in November. Why suddenly this problem?
Yeah, I'm not confirmed if that's what they're actually doing, but it seems to be, because when I heard back from NCDOT, they mentioned that kind of in light of the tax, they were going to stop. They were going to pause discussions about the temporary station. But basically what's happening here, I got a back and forth exchange between NCDOT and the city, and NCDOT had sent the city a letter saying that they had really deviated from the schedule. They were doing a lot of refinements to the plan. At some point, the developers came to the city and they said that the market was too weak to do this commercial construction, and they wanted the city to take on some more of the infrastructure work, like the station and the bus station as well. There's a train station and a bus station. And the city has just continued to prolong studies on that, according to NCDOT. The city came back. They said that they were willing to fund or help fund an early or temporary station, but they didn't think that they could fund both the early station and the permanent station. So now at this point, it seems like NCDOT might just put their hands up, said, okay, we'll pause discussions. Let us see what happens with the sales tax. And at this point, you know, the Gateway station's kind of, a train can come there. It has $86 million worth of infrastructure complete. A train can pull up there. There's just nowhere for anyone to get off. So I think it's very frustrating. And adding to this is NCDOT is on this timeline where they are getting new trains in 2030, and that's why they really want this done.
Yeah, NCDOT says that they want to make sure that the Charlotte region and the department's plans are well aligned. So that seems to say to me, maybe I'm wrong, that they're waiting on the outcome of this referendum in November. Does that mean that if we vote down the referendum, they are also likely to nix the Gateway station?
I don't think they would ever nix it. I mean, it's been a concept since the 90s, and they've already put $86 million into it. However, I do think it would continue to be this thing that just keeps getting delayed and never gets built. And it continues to be another one of Charlotte's plans that sits on the shelf.
Wow. So this week, the CMS Board of Education held their final meeting prior to the start of school, a meeting at which a lot of concerns surfaced about immigration enforcement.
Kids are scared of going into school again. Parents are scared of taking their kids to school. And that fear is not paranoia, but based on the reality that families are being harassed all across the country.
That's Myra Trinidad sharing her concerns about ICE with board members. How many in that meeting, James, shared her fears?
Quite a few. There was, I think, about 9 or 10 people who spoke on this issue specifically, and there were more in the crowd. We also had an instance where a woman in one of the upper levels of the chamber unfurled a banner that said, "Resist unjust orders, don't let ICE in schools." She was actually taken out by police. So it was a pretty tense meeting to kind of kick off the school year, I guess. And yeah, there was a lot of concern about much of what Myra said. We also heard from people who were basically kind of taking a stance of, you know, we don't want ICE anywhere near schools. Yeah. We shouldn't be cooperating with them at all. And yeah.
We spoke last month on this program with CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill about what the system was doing to inform teachers and staff and parents and students about school policies with regard to ICE. First and foremost, she says the system has made clear what it expects of teachers and staff and that they know how to respond to any ICE requests that might come their way. And she told us that the system is advising principals that school lobbies and parking lots are considered public spaces, so ICE can be there. Does that increase the concerns held by some parents?
Yeah, and many of the people who spoke referenced that specifically. I think it was when that came out, and I know, our own Julian Berger here had reported on that. When that came out, it prompted a lot of community concern about what this meant and what it looked like, and, you know, can ICE just like kind of camp out in these public places. The school board went to great lengths at the meeting to kind of allay those concerns and said that if ICE comes up without a warrant or a subpoena, yeah, they can be turned away. But yeah, that's been a huge source of concern in this debate.
Here's what some other parents told the board about their fears about ICE.
Charlotte Mecklenburg schools should not be cooperating with ICE. Schools are meant to be a safe place for students.
You guys have failed hundreds of immigrant children and their families.
ICE does not help students learn. All ICE does is sow distrust between students and adults.
How will our children be traumatized if and when they witness a teacher, a family member, or God forbid, one of their friends being taken from school by ICE?
Audio from WCNC-TV. Board members insisted that district policies prevent ICE from remaining on school campuses without a valid warrant or without subpoena, and that students are safe and welcome no matter their immigration status. School board member D. Rankin.
There are protocols that are put in place, and ICE cannot just come and set up on our campuses. What happens is if they don't have a warrant or a subpoena, they must leave our campuses.
That may be the policy of the school system, but given ICE activities that we've been witnessing elsewhere in this country, is there any reason to believe that ICE is on board with the CMS policy?
I think that we are in kind of uncharted waters with this, right? A lot of what prompted this, even going back to last year, was the Trump administration removing the status as a protected place for schools that ICE could not do enforcement on. So we've not really seen this before where ICE has kind of the go-ahead to conduct operations. Now, here in Charlotte, we haven't seen ICE actually go onto school campuses yet, so we don't know what that would look like. We do know that they did detain a parent last school year near the Charlotte East Language Academy, which prompted a lot of community concern at the time for that. So I think it's kind of hard to tell. You know, we know that ICE was told that they can conduct quote unquote common sense enforcement. But what that looks like in this age where we're seeing ICE operate in very different ways, which we've done a lot of reporting here with Julian Berger, that's tough to say.
Ben.
I always like to take a broader view of the situation, only because I feel like it's sometimes glossed over when we talk about ICE working with CMS or ICE working with the Sheriff's Department or with police. And regardless of what you feel about ICE, whether you're a huge fan or not, no matter what you feel about immigration, it's important to remember that a policy that discourages certain kids from going to school because they're scared, or discourages people from going to the ER to get treatment because they're scared, or discourages them from going to their job so they can pay bills. Anything that discourages that behavior can have a negative consequence, not just on those people, but has a negative consequence on their entire community and an entire city. And that is why for so long there was a precedent of sort of a deviation between ICE activities and all other sorts of activities when it comes to the government.
James, I want to get back to what you just said a moment ago, that the Trump administration has lifted guidelines that listed schools as protected places. In the context of the concerns expressed by these parents at that meeting, and the fact that policy is in place at CMS that says if you don't have a warrant, if you don't have a subpoena, you can't go into a classroom, you can't walk down the halls, you have to stay in the lobby, you have to stay in the parking lot. Why would ICE comply?
Yeah, I think that's some of what we heard from parents, was sort of like this sense of we need more specificity from this policy, all the what ifs, you know, what happens if they don't comply.
Why would ICE comply with any policy? It's the policy of the school system, not the policy of ICE.
Yeah, and I think that's difficult to say, again, without the precedent of seeing what this looks like at other schools and how this has played out and, you know, whether or not they would comply.
So there was a lot of frustration, and board member Liz Monterey Duvall said that any responsibility for excessive immigration enforcement at schools should be placed at the feet of the federal and state governments. That's where, she says, the anger and frustration should go, not the schools. Isn't that an admission that these concerns are justified despite CMS policy?
I think that there is a lot of consensus that at the very least, these policies are causing a lot of fear in the community. And one of the people who spoke to that, this is not just something that we've talking about hypothetically. We've seen in other areas around the country where ICE has been conducting enforcement, the way that they've been conducting themselves differently than what we've seen in the past, going to, for instance, courthouses and waiting for people when they leave courthouses. I think there is a sort of an admission there that, like, these concerns are valid. It's just a question of, has the school district put enough policies in place to account for all of those possibilities? And that, I think, is at the crux of this debate.
Okay, a story we'll have to continue following through the next school year. Aside from the referendum being on the ballot, we have an election for city council on the ballot in November, and it seems that the race for vacancies on council in this November's election, although it just got started, one candidate has already dropped out. Montravius King ended his campaign in favor of the incumbent, Tijuana Brown.
A lot of voters in District 3 still love and admire Councilwoman Brown. They have an emotional connection to her. I'm not going to go over that.
Tijuana Brown is under federal indictment, but is still in the race. She has not been convicted of any crime. She says she is innocent of the charges, and King is correct. Brown's indictment does not seem to have be holding any sway with most of her constituents. In fact, it rarely comes up in town hall meetings. Ben, why?
Well, I mean, you could make the argument that she's popular, but I think the broader thing is you got to think about, we're going to find out this fall whether or not it really resonates with her constituents. And also keep in mind that in a crowded primary like this, somebody's got to get to 30%. And if somebody doesn't get to 30%, then there's a runoff. And so while Montrevious King's not in there anymore, you've got Warren Turner and you've got Joy Mayo as well. So they've got to get past that primary before I feel comfortable saying that she is still popular with her constituents.
And this happened because allegedly the Black Political Caucus is not going to endorse him. We'll talk about that in a second. But Mr. King says that the Black Political Caucus has its finger on the pulse of District 3 and that he knows in his heart of hearts, quote, there is only one person in this race that truly loves and cares about the people, Tijuana Brown. Sources say that King finished third in the voting for the endorsement of the Black Political Caucus, but the results have yet to be announced. Alex, how does he know he finished third?
Yeah, I've also seen the tallies floating around, so I think that they've just gotten around the city. Okay. And Joy Mayo also, I believe, put out a press release where she celebrated winning the vote. I don't think it's final because the Black Political Caucus hasn't put anything out. And I know that Brown is contesting the vote, especially now that King has removed himself, even though he's still on the ballot, even though he suspended his campaign. She might be able to earn some of his votes, especially since he's now endorsing her.
Yeah, the other candidate in this race that we talk a lot about is Joy Mayo. She's been referred to several times in this segment. She's reported to have received 46 votes to Brown's 45 votes, and that has raised some questions about the endorsement process, at least from Tijuana Brown, who says some eligible voters did not receive a ballot. And Brown told WSOC-TV she's still optimistic.
I've spoken to the BPC about my concerns, and I would just say that there are some challenges, but because they are addressing them, I do want to keep it fair. They are addressing the challenges.
So the BPC released a statement saying that their endorsement process, quote, has maintained fairness and equity for over 60 years, enabling each member to express their preferences. They chose not to address comments about the process from any of the candidates at this time. Every year at back to school time, James, we talk about the number of teacher vacancies at CMS, and there will once again this year be teacher vacancies on the opening day of school, but evidently not as many as in previous years. So how many?
Yeah, so there are, right as of the school board meeting, there were 243 vacancies, and school officials say that's 55 less than where we were at this time last year.
And that's 1.3 teacher vacancies per school, if we've all done the math correctly. How have they been able to achieve that? Because that is an improvement.
So CMS will talk a lot about its recruitment strategies, and certainly we've seen a lot of that in the last couple of years. They pushed for an increase in the teacher supplement from the county during the budget process last spring. That was a big big push from the school board and from public school advocates. CMS has also launched its at-home initiative, where it's trying to link teachers up with affordable housing. And there's still talk about doing an educator community that would likely be located near Garinger High School. And yeah, so that's been a big part of it that they cite. We also saw last year they did cut some vacant positions in the budget. I think it was about 40 last year as they were trying to make the budget work. And that has also led to some larger student to teacher ratios as well.
Ben, did you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I actually, it goes beyond CMS. I think this is a broader regional trend. Speaking to the superintendent in Gaston County this week, I think they have 74 compared to like 117 last year. Same thing with the Cabarrus, same thing down with Rock Hill schools. I think all of these districts sort of have learned their lessons from the last few years. They're doing recruiting fairs and job fairs throughout the year to try to keep these numbers in a better place. And I think all of them are in a much better place than they were, say, coming out of the pandemic.
And James, you report that teacher attrition has been a problem across the state in recent years, with vacancies increasing in each of the last three school years, hitting a record high last year. So with these new numbers of just a fewer vacancies this year than last at the start of school, is CMS bucking that trend?
Yeah, it certainly seems like they could be on pace to do that. We won't know more until we get the State of the Teaching Profession report and hear some of the numbers we get from the state. But like Ben just said, I mean, it is kind of a regional thing too, so it could potentially be a sign of good things to come on the statewide level, but we won't know for sure until those numbers come out.
And yet we had a conversation earlier, as I said, with Dr. Crystal Hill, who's the CMS superintendent, and yesterday with the superintendents of Statesville-Iredell Schools, Cabarrus County Schools, and Union County Schools, and every one of them says that teacher pay is not high enough. I think we rank 43rd in the country out of 50 states and 39th in the country for first-year teachers. And teachers, people in college, are not gravitating toward the teaching profession because they're looking at those salaries and saying, I can make more money doing other things. So is the bottom line here, the bottom line going forward, are we going to have to convince people in Raleigh that we still need to increase teacher salaries?
I think that's definitely what educators will tell you about this issue. I mean, that's why schools have gotten more creative with their recruiting, with things like the affordable housing. But at the end of the day, until teacher salaries go up, we can't have much bigger movement on that.
If you look at the law, school is not supposed to start until August 25th, but some districts are already in session, and we're going to look at those scoff laws when we come back in a moment and find out how they're getting away with that and the state of post-pandemic learning, among other things. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. James Farrell is with us, our education reporter at WFAE News. Alexandria Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte, and Ben Thompson is the midday and morning anchor for WCNC-TV. The state of North Carolina's state-mandated start date for traditional public schools says it should start no earlier than the Monday closest to August 26th. In this case, August 25th. But students in Cabarrus County and in Iredell Statesville schools, as well as others in the state, opened their classrooms on Monday. Caldwell, Gaston, and Lincoln counties started on Wednesday. James, why?
Well, this has been a really contentious issue with schools for a long time who've been arguing that they want to start earlier. And some schools just kind of ignore the law and start earlier because there's not really a lot of consequences for doing so. CMS is not one of those schools. They have been reluctant to do so. But CMS and other districts have also talked about like going to a year-round schedule or finding other ways that they could make the schedule work the way they like without starting earlier.
I know you want to jump in on this, Ben, but I know that WCNC emailed the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction asking about possible consequences for starting early. What did they say?
Well, so far there is none. And that's been pretty consistent among the different superintendents I've talked to. They all admit, yeah, we've been talking to the state and they don't love it. But so far, it doesn't seem like the state's been willing to put any teeth into this law because, you know, I think about speaking to the superintendent over in Gaston County this past week, and he says, hey, listen, this is better for the students. It gets them in school and they can be done with the semester and exams by Christmas break. We've tried it both ways. We were open-minded. This just makes the most sense for our students. And as I'm sure you'll get into, the reason we do this is mainly because the tourism industry and folks out at the beach and up in the mountains, and they like that money that comes from families going around the state, you know, June, July, and all of August. And that's great for them, but superintendents will argue every single time that might be great for tourism, but that is not the best for our students.
I think the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction also told you that individuals or groups can bring lawsuits against local boards of education to require compliance with the law. To the best of anyone's knowledge, has that ever happened?
I'm not aware of it. And I think to Ben's point there, I think a lot of people like this concept of starting earlier. So I don't know how much of an appetite there would be for that. You know, like Ben said, a lot of parents, too. There's been surveys here in CMS of people who want CMS to advocate for this earlier start date because they like having all the tests and everything wrapped up before the holidays so their kid isn't coming home and studying during Christmas break.
So before we move away from education, James, remote learning during the pandemic threw a lot of students for a loop, and now a new report highlights just how hard it has been for those students to bounce back. This report comes from Curriculum Associates. Who are they, and what did they find?
Sure. So Curriculum Associates is a group that creates iReady, which is an adaptive learning platform. CMS parents might be familiar with iReady. Students at CMS use it to kind of diagnose their academic strengths and weaknesses. So Curriculum Associates pulled data from around 14 million students nationwide to kind of look at these trends of how they've been doing both pre-pandemic and in the years since the pandemic. And the big finding, the big overall kind of big picture takeaway is that students are by and large kind of plateauing since COVID. They're still learning, they're still seeing improvements, but not at the rate that's necessary to catch up to where they were pre-pandemic.
The sample size is extraordinary in the survey. They surveyed 14 million students across the country, including those at CMS. And you recently spoke, James, to Kristen Huff, who's the head of measurements for Curriculum Associates. And she told you that post-pandemic improvements, as you have said, have largely plateaued in K through 8 math and reading, while younger students, K through 3rd, are scoring at pre-COVID levels. They're actually doing better. But that isn't the only good news.
A bright spot is that, yes, students are learning. They are learning at about the same rate that they were learning at historically. But in order to catch up, that rate needs to accelerate.
So clearly schools are working toward that end. Do you hear from CMS or any of the other surrounding districts about how they feel about achieving that goal?
Well, I think that we're going to get a big benchmark in that in just a couple of weeks. In September, we'll get the test results from all the state exams, and that'll be a big benchmark for a lot of people, especially with reading. As you know, and I listened to the show yesterday, I know the superintendents were talking about this too, there's been a big investment in the science of reading statewide. We've seen a lot of gains in the younger levels in North Carolina here from that, you know, the K through 3 students. What we haven't seen is that really translating to the same success from like grades 3 to 8, the students who are taking the EOG exams, which are the state exams. I think a lot of people are going to be watching those test results when they come out in September to see what comes of that and if we see any signs of the success that we're seeing with the younger grades kind of trickling to those older grades.
There is a governor's race in South Carolina that is shaping up to be interesting, to say the least. Henry McMaster, the current governor, has been term limited, and there are more than a few Republicans vying to take his place. One of them is Representative Nancy Mace. She announced her candidacy last week and was in Rock Hill to outline her platform. Alex, what did she have to say about that platform?
Well, she talked a lot about how she wants to, I believe her slogan is hold the line, or one of her slogans, hold the line on DEI. She's very pro-ICE. And then, of course, she had to respond to some of her protesters who were outside because she's pretty used to getting this strong opposition. And that was kind of the thing that made the big headlines.
Which we'll talk about. But she wants to eliminate the state income tax in South Carolina. She wants to overhaul the criminal justice system, expand school choice, vocational education, pursue judicial reform, and improve the state's energy options. I'm not sure what any of that means, but how much detail did she go into with regard to those things? Anybody know? Okay. She spoke at a brewery in Rock Hill. That's why nobody knows. And even though she has just declared that this, and well, let me back up. She just declared her candidacy, and already she's calling this a two-person race between her and South Carolina's Attorney General Alan Wilson. And then she made some serious allegations about him.
Right now, this is a two-man race, and this is a fight between good and evil, because what the Attorney General has done to this state is evil. He has bragged about human and sex trafficking being up over 400% and says that's a good thing. It is not.
To be clear, she's talking about a fellow Republican here, but let's talk about her accusations. Has anyone fact-checked her claim that the Attorney General has bragged that human sex traffic is up over 400% and he has characterized that as being a good thing? Has anybody fact-checked that?
I've not seen that anywhere reported in any sort of media across the Carolinas, anywhere.
Okay. Meanwhile, she says that she wants to focus on crime and go after those who she says are not doing their job to address it.
As governor, I will do everything to protect every single South Carolinian. And I will take on the AG. I will take on the solicitors who are not doing their jobs and not prosecuting criminals.
To what is she referring? I've stumped the panel again. Okay. She also faced a barrage, as you said, Alex, of protests outside the venue. The state newspaper reported that dozens of people protested with chants and signs reading things like, quote, Nancy Mace is a disgrace, wasting time and spewing hate. Inside, she called the protesters lunatics and added,
they're hiding behind a mask because they're too scared to show their face. They're not man enough to come into the room and ask the tough questions.
But the state newspaper reported that at least one protester had a ticket but was denied entrance. Meanwhile, she told the group inside that gays need to divorce the trannies. That's her word. And she was asked about her use of that slur later by a reporter.
Are you offended by the word Yeah, because you're fake news and you're a raging Democrat.
Ben, we got that sound from WCNC. Did your station bleep the use of that word, or was it bleeped by another news organization?
No.
How did that work?
I believe we bleeped the use of that word, and we were there for that press conference. And I actually watched this unfold, and it was a first rally of a campaign. It was very combative, which is part of Mace's, I guess, signature style now. But you know, keep in mind, this has become a big issue for her. But it was just 4 or 5 years ago where she like strongly said she was a big supporter of the LGBTQ community when it comes to rights and equality. As you alluded to, she now says the gay community should divorce the trans community altogether. And keep in mind, I mean, I think one study said that the trans community represents 0.5% of the population in South Carolina. And so for gubernatorial candidate to be taking this on as her big issue, I think might be surprising for some, considering some of the other big issues facing the state of North Carolina.
I, not to be critical, but I don't think we should bleep the word. If a candidate says it, it's news, and she said it, and she said it multiple times in congressional hearings. So not only did she say it on the stump, it's part of the congressional record. Let's go into something even more delicious. Alex? You had dinner recently at the Charlotte Jail, and you paid $80 to eat there. You could have gotten a small steak at Morton's for that. So why did you do this?
Because I saw this advertisement for this event to eat the jail, and I said, what the heck is this all about? I had to go and figure out what it was. It got a lot of criticism because people thought this was glorifying jail or taking advantage of incarcerated. I wanted to go see for myself what it was all about. I feel like the organizers did have good intentions. The purpose of the event was to sit down with these, the detention center calls them residents. So we sat down with residents, had a meal together. The idea was to break the stigma. The meal was inspired by commissary items, and the residents who were there had helped kind of inspire the meals by talking about things that they missed and that they couldn't get in the detention center, and then also some of their commissary items that they used to elevate their flavor, so things like Flamin' Hot Cheetos.
Yeah. So I read your article about this, and you said this was a five-course meal inside the detention center, as you said, inspired by commissary items with jail detainees as some of your fellow diners. How were the outside guests chosen? How were the inside guests chosen? Who prepared the meal?
Okay, so the outside guests, most of them were part of a group called Charlotte Foodies. They're known for throwing these very unconventional pop-up dinners. The residents were chosen from a reentry program that they were involved in, where Mecklenburg County Detention Center tries to help them with their mental health challenges or addiction, things like that, so that when they get back into society, it's a smooth transition. Mm-hmm. And our chef was Chef Eric Crawford. He's from Davidson. His restaurant is in Davidson. It's called Marley Jean's. And the food was really good. So
this was not food that they eat in the jail regularly, simply inspired by the food that they eat. Was it worth the $80? That's the final question.
I think it was, because it was a very unique experience. And I think a lot of people had different takeaways. So it's not just, you mean, you're only paying for the ingredients. It's like a nonprofit event. So.
And I lied. That's not the final question, because the organizers say this is not about glorifying jail or turning incarceration into entertainment. But I'm curious as to how the inmates that you ate with felt about this.
Yeah, so the resident that I ate with at my table, we were at tables of four, he was really quiet, but I could tell he was really optimistic. And at the end, he said, like, you guys are really kind people. And I think they were all just happy to be there and to be a part of something. I think everybody in the room did feel like it was really genuine, and they weren't trying. There weren't any, like, negative intentions. So I think a lot of the residents did feel good about it.
Ben, the city of Monroe issued a boil water notice this week, which affected thousands of people. Why?
Well, because evidently E. coli was found in the western part of Monroe near one of the fire stations there. And so this closed down schools, closed down businesses, closed down restaurants, coffee shops yesterday. They believe heavy rains recently might be the reason behind this. As it stands right now at 9:55, it's lifted for most of Monroe. The western zone of where that water district covers, it is still under boil water advisory, but that's expected to be lifted by sometime this afternoon.
And although most of the rest of the nation observes Gay Pride in June, Charlotte holds their observances in August, and this year will be the 25th anniversary of Charlotte Pride, but this year they're also facing some challenges. For instance, Ben.
Well, it's corporate challenges. You know, the sort of mood in the country has shifted, and so there's a lot of companies that have wanted to maybe take part, but didn't want to be public about it. I mean, you know, the banking community here in Charlotte has always been a big supporter of Pride, going back 15 years or longer. And I think this year, because of that sort of political climate, you've seen maybe companies still wanting to support, but maybe wanting to be less public about their support. You know, I'll be interested in watching things this weekend. And you know, going to Pride 15 years ago, there were always a lot of loud protesters that would be there mm-hmm. as well. And they really sort of diminished over the last few years, and it just really became less of a controversial thing. I'll be interested to see if some of those protesters feel emboldened.
Which was helped, I think, by the fact that major corporations and even some local companies, including WFAE, which is a media sponsor for Charlotte Pride, in the interest of full disclosure, because we were there and signs were there supporting that, that may have muted some of that. But this so-called rainbow capitalism is changing, according to Meredith Thompson, who is the managing director of Charlotte Pride.
It's really weird and interesting when folks are saying, okay, we're going to contribute at the same level, but I don't want you to put our logo on anything because, you know, the higher ups are worried that, you know, a photograph could be taken out of place, or there's going to just be some sort of online controversy that we have to mitigate, and that's going to just be a distraction.
So some of them have removed their logos. Some of them have removed their sponsorship, and I'm told that they're about $100,000 in debt. That's one-tenth of their million-dollar budget. The county kicked in $125,000 to fill the gap. And just so people know, Charlotte Pride generates about $16 million in economic impact. And that's all the time we have. Ben Thompson, morning and midday anchor for WCNC-TV, Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte, and James Farrell, our education reporter here at WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.